dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week I began a reading of a remarkable book, Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. It's a book for people who are fundamentally revolted by this society and who seek a much more sweeping change in our relationships to one another and the planet than is ever offered or possible within the electoral spectacle of our so-called democracy. This is a radical book in that it gets to root questions such as, is our hierarchical repressive society reflective of human nature? Why do people put up with the meaningless lives offered by the capitalist workplace and consumer society? The reading will continue in the second hour. During the course of the book reading that will take many weeks, I'm also playing other material that relates to the ideas in Power and Powerlessness. This week, we'll begin the show with a talk by Boston University sociologist and author Juliet Shore on her 2004 book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. This talk was given at a conference of educators in Vancouver, BC, in 2005, and it's still totally relevant 3 years later. We have this thanks to the producers of Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Here's Professor Juliet Shore.
I'm going to talk this morning about the issue of children and commercialism. The growing commercialization of childhood is affecting kids' lives, their well-being, in increasingly adverse ways. It's also affecting schools. It's a trend that has really is oozing out into virtually every place that kids are. And it's affecting schools in ways that would have been almost unimaginable 10 years ago. When I wrote those words, I thought, you know, these ways are almost unimaginable even today as they are taking place. There are sort of mind-boggling things that are going on. My research is in the United States, but I think that the trends are common from what I've, you know, already just being here a day, picked up about some of what's going on here in Canada. And I also think that you will, in coming years, begin to see some of the things that we are already experiencing, as, you know, is often the case with reactionary trends coming from down south. Let me begin with some background, which is to say that growing commercial influence has become a pervasive presence in children's lives almost from birth. Here are some little factoids. We have now in the United States what marketers call cradle-to-grave marketing. So the minute a kid is born, they begin to be targeted by brands, which are trying to create a brand loyalty from the beginning because companies understand how lucrative capturing a kid at an early age can be, because if they can get that brand loyalty, they can have them throughout their entire lives. And for some kinds of products, the sort of figure in the literature is like it's a $100,000 asset if you can get a kid for your product. And some of these things really do stick when you think about, you know, Coke versus Pepsi or some of these basic, really basic brand loyalties that people get into at a pretty early stage. So we have infant websites. Almost from when kids are born, they're put in front of infant commercial websites. We have television for one-year-olds, introduced, of course, ironically, by our public television station, PBS, you know, your CBC equivalent. Teletubbies, a program geared to one-year-olds, despite the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics says that no child under two should even watch any television at all. And this program has, in addition to a huge licensing empire of toys and so on and so forth, fast food tie-ins with Burger King and McDonald's, so that we've got one-year-olds being lured with toys to fast food places. The Pepsi-Cola has licensed its logo to put on infant formula bottles. And one of the things that researchers have found is that a significant number of those bottles are now actually containing soda pop rather than formula or milk. Computer use begins at a really early age. We've got two-year-olds, of course, on computers in what the marketers call immersive brand environments. I was at a marketing conference yesterday where I was debating marketers, and one of the people there was a man who had invented a site, a kid's site called Neopets. I don't know if it's known here. It was originally started with a good idea, teach a kid responsibility, how to take care of a pet. Now, of course, as has happened with so many websites, they are highly commercialized, so it has McDonald's, an immersive McDonald's environment there, where a child earns food for its pets by seeing commercials for McDonald's or taking its pet to McDonald's and so forth. And that is called an immersive brand environment, or a sticky brand environment. The child is interacting with that advertising for very long periods of time. And, of course, that's the whole point, is to create a sticky environment that the child can't get out of. At 18 months, American kids are now clearly recognizing logos and brands. At age 2, their product requests have become significantly brand-oriented. So they no longer ask for a category. It's not, I want a hamburger, I want French fries, I want McDonald's, I want Burger King. So they have that strong brand recognition and brand requests for many kinds of products by age 2. By age 3, kids are talking about the ways in which brands represent their basic personalities. So they have figured out, you know, a key aspect of branding, which is that brands are trying to connect with kids on a deep emotional level with who they are, their very sense of identity, and that they are now articulating as early as age 3. I like Nike because I'm powerful. Or I'm smart, and this is the brand for smart kids. Or I'm nice, and, you know, et cetera. We have a rise in marketing in preschools, a whole range of sponsored curricula, which are sent free to preschools, whether it's for Clifford the Bear or Clifford the Red Dog, the Care Bears, all of these licensed media characters, and they're getting preschool curricula. A fourth of our preschoolers now have televisions in their own rooms. So you see that even before these kids walk into your schools, they have been deeply, deeply immersed in a commercial world, which is affecting them in very profound ways and is a key organizing principle now of their lives. The marketing heats up as kids get into the elementary school years. And the hottest area of there's a lot going on in the so-called 0 to 3, the preschooler range, but the hottest area in terms of dollars and also kind of insidious innovation in recent years has been what marketers call tweens. Now, here's a really incredible thing. A tween is supposed to be between childhood and adolescence. And yet, the tween is actually, what are the years that are defined as the tween years? There's some debate out there in the marketing literature. I mean, that's kind of dignifying it to call it a literature, but in the marketing world, there's some debate out there about what it is. I would say the most common figure is 8 to 12, but I've also seen people talking about the 6 to 12. So the idea that now a 6-year-old is no longer a child, she's between childhood and adolescence. And you see that in so many ways, in the way the products which are being marketed to these kids. For example, 6-year-olds who used to be marketed, girls, marketed with, let's say, glamour products like makeup. It would be a little plastic makeup kit, a fake lipstick and fake this and that. I remember those little lipsticks from when I was a kid. Today, companies have begun marketing real makeup to 6-year-olds. Not just lipstick, but also blush and, of course, nail polish and a whole range of other beauty products. So you've gone from a make-believe, pretend world into the real thing at age 6. The Bratz, which are the successor to Barbie, the Bratz doll, successor to Barbie, highly sexualized, a lot more attitude than Barbie. I mean, Barbie looks tame in comparison. Marketing to, and that's a sort of, you know, 6-year-old prime age for these dolls, blind date Bratz dolls, where Saturday, it's a sort of Saturday night blind date doll where the 6-year-old is enacting going out on the blind date. One of the activist groups is upset about this, the idea of, it's a dad's group, teaching these girls that they should be going out on Saturday night with people they don't know, especially at 6 years old. Okay, so that's tweening. They call it tweening. Your kids are already getting tweened by the time they show up at your schools, and here are some of the things that are happening. The average American kid is watching 5.5 hours a day of media. Over half of that is television. If you count the times when they are, the total media use, when they're doing two media at once, which is increasingly common, it's about 7-8 hours a day of total media exposure. And that media exposure directly correlates to advertising exposure because increasingly what media is, I mean, it's always been this to a certain extent, but more and more it's just an advertising vehicle. It's an advertising delivery system. The number of ads, television ads, that the average American kid is exposed to doubled between the 70s and the 90s, and there hasn't been an update on this. It's higher now, I'm sure. By the mid-90s, it was about 110 ads a day. So it's over that now. Disney and Viacom just paid millions, but peanuts to them, fines to the Federal Communication Commission for exceeding the allowable numbers of commercials per hour, I mean, which is already huge. And the total commercial time per hour of TV in the United States continues to increase. There are virtually no ad-free internet sites for children. We have increasing advertising in movies, both if you go to the movies, you sit through now many minutes of advertising before the movie starts, but also a huge increase in undisclosed product placement in movies and television. And there's a lot of talk now about moving the whole TV system to a pure product placement system because people can zap the ads. In which the shows are built around branded environments. And increasingly you see plot lines being built around this. And it's really hard to go to a Hollywood movie today without being, I find it hard to watch them anymore without just being, you know, obsessed with all of the product placements in there. And they're raking in huge dollars from those product placements. There are big offices for every movie that gets made now, and huge staffs, and what they do is just go out and sell space in those movies. There's something called viral marketing, which is person-to-person marketing, which started big time with adolescents and has migrated down to kids. And what it is companies enlisting kids to market to their friends and to other kids. There's a company I exposed in my book called the Girls Intelligence Agency. A lot of these viral marketing companies have stealth themes because you're supposed to do it stealthily. So GIA, take off on the CIA. Their website is like a prototype of the CIA and so forth. They have what are called secret agent girls. They claim to have something like 40,000 of them. I don't know. I suspect that's an overestimate. These are tween girls, and they are enlisted to hold slumber parties at their homes. They invite about 10 of their friends to these slumber parties. There's no mechanism for necessarily even informing the girls who are coming or their parents that these are going to be marketing events. And the girls come, and then either they are doing a focus group kind of research thing for the company where they're shown a new product or a show and they're asked to talk about it and so forth, or it's the unveiling of a product and they're giving them samples and trying to get them invested in the product, and then they'll give them extras that which they're then supposed to go out and give to their friends. This company has held hundreds, I think they claim thousands, probably thousands of these parties all over the country. They have some of the biggest companies in the country as their clients, Disney, Fox, etc. And they are shamelessly infiltrating the very basic social worlds of kids. I profile also the Hasbro company, the number two toy company in the United States, a viral rollout they did on a product where they enlisted over 1,000 what they call alpha boys. These are the socially dominant kids. And their whole model is to find the socially dominant kids and market through them because they're the ones who are cool and they can set the trends. And when you hear this debate about, oh, well, it's all driven by peer pressure, you can't just blame marketing. What has happened now is that distinction no longer holds. The marketers have infiltrated the basic social dynamics of kids. Hasbro went out and interviewed thousands and thousands of kids to find their 16. They had 1,600 of these alpha boys who unveiled their product. They also went to, they were called like secret agents. And the way they did it was by going to schools. It was a school-based plan, by the way, as many of these are, because they see the contagion possible in the schools. They went to schools, teachers, parents, kids on playgrounds, etc., and they started asking, who's the coolest kid you know? And when they would get the answer to that, they'd go to that kid and say, who's the coolest kid you know? Who's the coolest kid you know? Until they found the 1,600 who were the coolest kids. By the way, one other thing about this Hasbro, which as teachers you'll be interested in. The product was it's a little handheld game, like a Game Boy, but it has an added feature. It's called Pox. It didn't succeed, but Pox. It's like, that was another thing. They did focus groups with the kids. The kids thought that was really, you know, Pox, infection, and it's a game of alien invasion and destruction. The reason it didn't succeed was that it was rolled out 10 days after September 11th, and they were afraid to advertise for it because of what had happened. So that was just a bad timing. But So when I was at the ad agency, I forgot to say, a lot of what I learned was because I sort of went undercover into an advertising industry, into an agency, and did a lot of interviews and so forth. And so I was at an ad agency that was promoting this game. It has a radio frequency feature in which games can communicate with each other, so kids can be playing games. It's not just the Game Boy is a single player. It's a multiplayer game. And you can set the game up and put it in your backpack and play without actually touching it. And so the idea was, the teachers wouldn't know you were playing because it could be in your backpack or your desk. So you could play during school. And both the agency and the company were thinking about a school ban. That was their, like, the not everyone at the company, but they understood that this would be the ultimate in success if they could get the toy banned at school, because it would mean that kids had become so addicted to it that they couldn't stop playing at school and it was disrupting school life. Okay, enough about viral marketing. Stealth marketing is another aspect. Some of the viral goes under stealth, but it's a separate category they talk about. And it's basically the idea of marketing without the consumer knowing they're being marketed to. So undisclosed product placement is an example of that. The peer-to-peer marketing where the kids don't tell their friends that they're being paid by or enlisted by a marketing company. Deceptive advertisement in which kids, these companies have been creating ads which look like public service announcements and the kids are unable to distinguish them. And this is for the older kids who are skeptical about ads and more savvy. And so if the company like Pepsi-Cola has done this, make an ad that looks like a public service announcement, the kids will think Pepsi is promoting a good message for kids when it's really just an ad. One of the things I was not allowed to write about was an ad for a candy bar, Twix, in which they paid DJs to insert an ad into the songs that they play at clubs. And it comes in very subtly, so you don't really know it's an ad in there, but it's their little jingle that got mixed into what are called, the mix, they call them the mixes, the music mixes that the DJs do all over the country. DJs were paid $1,500 to mix in this ad a certain number of times in what they were playing. Now, there's a huge research effort behind all of this advertising, and this is something that's new. If you think about kids' advertising in the past, it was a low-budget thing. It was a backwater of the industry. It cost very little to advertise on Saturday morning television compared to prime time. Kids didn't have money. Kids' consumer culture was a cheap culture. If you think about things like penny candy, well, it only cost a penny. Cheap plastic toys. That's what the kids, I mean, we're not all the same age in this room, but for many of us growing up, our relationship with consumer culture was with cheap stuff. Because that's all kids could afford. We didn't have a lot. We had a little bit of allowance money. We'd get, a little bit of money. That has changed dramatically. And that's a big part of why all this is happening. You can't understand it without reference to the fact that kids have enormous purchasing power today. Lots of money given to them by their parents and grandparents and other folks. And that has made them a much more lucrative target. And this really gets going in the 1990s in the United States during the boom years of the 1990s. One of the groups that benefits dramatically from that is kids, whose consumer stuff gets astronomically upscaled. And that's when you get kids, buying the $150 sneakers that are the thing that adults really, focus on because they know these sneakers cost a couple of bucks to make, and yet the kids are desperate to buy them, $80, $100, et cetera. But it's happening across all kinds of products. It's also why the kids, the companies are shifting from the little plastic makeup kits to the real makeup because those cost a lot more. And that tweening is part of what is behind it is taking much more expensive products and moving them down to the kids. So I just did some stuff in the public schools in my town, and there was a kids' newspaper that wrote an article about my talk and my book. And one of the fourth grade girls was interviewed about what are the hot products now. This is for fourth graders. Uggs. Have you had the UGG phenomenon here? The expensive sheepskin boots, which cost over $100. UGGs and iPods. And I'm sure you've also got the iPod thing, which I see it in my college students. It's an object of obsession among the college students who don't have it. But it's also the cool thing among fourth graders. That's an expensive product, something that would have been unheard of for a little kid to have something so expensive in the past. So now that kids have so much more money, the advertising rates on their programs have gone up, and companies are spending a lot more money to address them, which means they have to spend a lot more on research, Because the old story was the people who were in kids marketing were people who had kids, and what they did was what their kids liked. So they just used their own kids as kind of their total research sample, you know, all two of them. What's happened now is an unbelievable amount of research on children of so many different types, some of it very insidious. I interviewed marketers who go into people's homes, videotape the kids doing virtually everything, eating, grooming, playing, you name it. They videotape what's in their closets. They go into bathrooms and watch them take baths in order to figure out new health and beauty aid products. I mean, it is that extensive. Virtually everything that, I shouldn't say virtually, I haven't heard about sleeping. But, you know, other than sleeping, every waking activity that kids are involved in, marketers are busy watching. They're videotaping them in stores, in playgrounds, on the streets. I haven't seen videotaping in schools, but they are in schools watching. And I talked to one marketer whose company set up shop in a school for 6 weeks, studying what kids were doing, and not only that, they were able to set homework assignments for kids. Homework assignments like, tell me the five things you like about a candy bar. And this information is then fed back to the client companies. So incredible research. They're also doing what's called neuromarketing, which is MRI scanning on brains. I found one guy who had done it with young people. And that will be coming. They're doing a lot more of it with adults at the moment. What all this, and thousands and tens of hundreds of thousands of kids are surveyed and interviewed and, you know, standard kind of techniques. There is an explosion of research information on kids. And what this has done is allow the marketers to create incredibly sophisticated messages. Here's an example of a commercial that is so beyond sophisticated. And, you know, the really horrible thing is that it's for the most nefarious of purposes, which is, as you know, the United States is involved in a war in Iraq. We have occupied Iraq in a horrible, unethical, illegal, insane way. And how do we get... the Bush administration has a problem because soldiers are dying in Iraq. They're going crazy. They're coming home and blowing their brains out. It's awful. And word is getting back, and they don't have enough soldiers. They've also got a war going on in Afghanistan. They got a little covert war they've started in Iran. They got plans for God only knows how many more places. They need bodies in the military. They don't want to bring back a draft, so they have stepped up military recruiting just very intensively. Military recruiting commercials are being shown in high schools among low-income high schools and rural schools, which is the schools that have something called Channel 1, which is advertising to kids in schools. A lot of military recruiting. I was watching a commercial. It starts out in a high school cafeteria, very multicultural look to it. Very cool guy starts walking around from table to table and pulling food, just taking pieces of, you know, food out of, you know, kids are sitting there eating their lunch, and he's stealing a piece from a couple, you know, going from one table to another, and he gets three or four items. And you're thinking, like, well, what is this? It's like some bully in the classroom going around just ripping off food that his classmates are eating. He's incredibly handsome, the ultimate in cool. He's some, you know, undefined racial identity. And he picks up all that stuff and puts it in his hand, and he goes out, walks out of the school, and right at the door there is a poor homeless man. And he hands him the stuff. And then the commercial goes to this video game thing. You know, the planes, and it's just like a video game. And then at the end, it's, you know, U.S. Army, be all that you can be, or I don't know, maybe that's the Marines, whatever their slogan is. Now, having, you know, this is such a brilliant commercial. Having seen, you know, been in the industry, I know that one of the big things that the marketers are talking about now is how much young people care about doing good. They are really, they really, really want to be good in the world, especially teenagers. I mean, they're just, it matters a lot to them. And so they create a commercial, you know, to entice people to go and do this really horrible thing, occupy a country, on the basis of, on the one hand, this intense desire to be good, and on the other hand, the boys' fascination with video games and this idea that if you go to the military, it's like, you know, a 24-hour video game. But I offer this commercial as an example of the incredibly sophisticated messaging that the industry is figuring out on the basis of this intensive research that they're doing, and how they're really able to connect with kids in very intense ways. What are the messages that they are, what are the messages they are giving? Well, one of them I just mentioned, which is cool. It is the sort of core of all messaging for kids' consumer culture. It's that cool is what matters. My product makes you cool. And the surveying I've done and looking at other research that's been done, the fraction of kids, and especially little kids, who believe that cool is important is amazing. Because in the past, little kids didn't care about being cool. They wanted to have fun. Cool is a social value. Cool is something that teenagers would care about. But the idea that we now have third and fourth graders for whom being cool is really important is in large part due to marketing, because they have shifted marketing from what you could say a sort of utilitarian perspective, which says, buy my product because it's fun, buy my to play with, buy my product because it tastes good, to buy my product because it makes you cool. And the psychological implications of that, I think, are profound. And this is the number one marketing messages to kids in all kinds of products that have nothing to do, you know, in some sense, with cool, especially food. Candy, for example, typically marketed as a cool product rather than this stuff tastes good. Second one I've talked about a little bit, this tweening thing. They also call it kids are getting older, younger. It's their justification for marketing teen and adult messages and products to young kids. And you see this with violent stuff. The year I was finished writing my book, the hot new trend at the toy fair, which is coming up next week in New York, was violent action figures for preschoolers. And some of the things that some of the extreme ones are amazing, world wrestling and so forth. Action figures which go with PG-13 and R movies being marketed to little preschoolers. But the levels of violence, of course, in the media, you know a lot about that. Sexuality being marketed to little kids. One of the marketers I talked to for my book told me a story about, she was doing in-home videotaping. She said, you know, she basically moved in with a family. She was did the research behind AT&T's M-Life campaign, which is the sort of mobile, their, you know, cell phone. It was a big campaign. Videotaping a three-year-old doing a Britney Spears bump and grind kind of dancing imitation. And she said to the girl, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the little girl replied, a sexy t-shirt girl. Three-year-olds. Kids coming home from preschool, you know, immersed in that world of pop music. I mean, that used to be a teen thing. So you see that whole range of tween marketing and even below, the marketing of sex, violence. You also have tobacco and alcohol marketing to young kids because they're widely exposed to the adult media where this stuff is there. Let me mention one other major theme It connects with cool, but it deserves a little discussion of all its own, which is anti-adultism in children's marketing. It's a major theme. Many products are advertised with the idea that it's a cool kid product, that the marketer understands the kid. Nickelodeon, which is, you know, maybe the most successful kid brand out there at the moment. Do you have Nickelodeon here? I assume you do, yeah. Okay, it's a cable network and lots of other stuff too. Nickelodeon's basic philosophy is kids rule. They talk about the empowerment of kids. Okay, that sounds pretty nice. But what does kids rule really mean? In practice, in many ways, it means Nickelodeon is saying to the kid, we're on your side. We're the one who understands you. Well, who doesn't understand you? Your parents and your teachers. They're the problem. They're the ones who are making you so stressed. They're the ones who are putting all these demands on you, and we, the marketer, are going to free you from that. We're going to give you a utopian space, which is adult-free, which is where we can make fun of the adults. And there's a whole range of, if you look at commercials and media products and so forth, out there in kids' consumer culture, in which adults are dorks, nerds, creeps, the uncool, etc. Famous commercial, Starburst candy commercial, in which you have the dorky teacher at the front of the room, and when he's writing on the board, people know this one? There's a riot in the classroom. They're all eating the candy, and they're having a party, and it's incredible fun. And when he turns back around to face the classroom, it's drab, it's horrible, it's oppressive, and he turns back around, and the riot starts again. And that's the theme. It's that parents, teachers, adults are the enemy. They're the problem. And Nickelodeon has very brilliantly figured out from its research one of the overriding factors of childhood today, which is that kids are intensely stressed out. In the United States, the average stress level of kids today, so the average kid today has a stress level which is equivalent to the levels recorded in children in 1957 who were inpatients in psychiatric clinics and hospitals. So a pathological level of stress in 1957, the kids who were so stressed and screwed up that they were inpatients in hospitals, that's the average level of stress we have today among American kids. And marketers have figured out brilliantly how to market to stressed out kids. And this idea that the marketer is the one who understands you're stressed out and we're the ones who are going to free you from all that pressure, I believe is an important, because that stress is real, is a really important part of how successful they've been in capturing kids' loyalty, attention, connection, and part of the problem of connections between kids and adults today, parents and teachers. And in my research, I tested to see whether kids who are more, I did a survey of kids, 300 kids, school-based survey, grades ages 10 through 13, so that prime tween age, getting lots of marketing. Do the kids who are more immersed in consumer culture, who are more into the media, who care more about the values of consumer culture, who have been more sucked into this, are those kids more alienated from their parents? Does the message that your parent is boring, that your parent is uncool, that your parent doesn't understand you, which is the message of kids' consumer culture, has that message gotten to kids, and do they believe that? And what I found is that in my suburban locale, which was two-thirds of my sample, that is the case. The children who are more involved in consumer culture are more alienated from their parents. They are more likely to feel their parent doesn't understand them. They are less likely to feel their parent is there for them and feel connected to their parent. And that's a really profound thing, and I think it comes in part out of this messaging that the marketers are giving. Interesting thing about the urban kids, most of whom were in single-parent families, they're very bonded to their mothers, and you didn't see this. But in the suburban families, you did. Couple more points. many more places where kids are being marketed to. In zoos, museums, the Girl Scouts have a fashion adventure badge now where you go to the mall instead of to the forest. Honest to God. The big enchilada of ad creep, of course, is the public schools. The corporate infiltration of schools has its origins in the 1980s in the United States with the Reagan administration as part of a long-term right-wing grand vast conspiracy to take over, to privatize public schools. As you know, I mean, same kind of issues you're dealing with. Schooling is a huge profit opportunity, which is off limits to companies right now, and they don't like that. You have the same kinds of ideas being put forward with our prison system, the welfare system, healthcare, the military. Of course, we have a big fight about Social Security going on now, privatizing of that. But all of those areas you have seen major, with the exception so far of Social Security, major incursions of private provision. We have privately provided welfare services, prisons, etc. They've also made a lot of headway in schools. We now have for-profit schools and so forth. There are two aspects of this thing. One is the operating schools for profit. The other is the commercial infiltration of schools, so opening them up as commercial spaces. The long-term plan, which they've been very successful with, is to erode public support for the schools by saying the schools are bad and the schools are failing, which is basically a mythology. I mean, our inner-city schools are bad because they're unfunded. The suburban schools, I think, are a lot better now than they were in the past, but virtually no parents understand that. I think the right wing's been very successful in this myth of the failing school across the board. To starve them of funds to facilitate corporations moving in, to impose costly regulations on the schools, which they can't meet, and which to meet they have to funnel money to private corporations. The testing scam in the U.S. is the big example of this. The people getting rich on the testing are companies with strong ties to the Bush administration, private companies who are getting billions of dollars. Corporations wanted to gain more control also of the content of the curriculum, particularly companies like the energy companies and the mining and paper and so forth, where real environmental education was getting put in and kids were actually learning about what they were doing. So they have succeeded in going into the schools and addressing curricular issues as well as opening them up for advertising in many different ways. And it is exploding. Since the late 90s, the indices of school commercialism have gone off the charts. Channel One is probably the most famous commercial infiltration. It's a 10-minute quote-unquote news broadcast with 2 minutes of that being direct advertising, and the news is pretty flaky. I mean, whether it's – there's a little bit of news in there, but a lot of it's other kinds of disguised advertising. 40% of American kids are forced to watch Channel 1 every day. They are contractually obligated. All the schools got for this, which is – this is the biggest scam. All they got for this is some TV monitors with volume controls that cannot be adjusted so that teachers can't turn down the volume. And they are contractually obligated to show this broadcast every day. There are a lot of battles over Channel 1. And Gary Ruskin, are you here? Gary Ruskin, who will be here later today, has led a lot of those. And there have been some activist victories on those. Second thing I write a lot about in my book is called sponsored educational materials. You probably have those. They are corporate-created, quote-unquote, curricula, which are basically ads. They're glossy. They're expensive. They get sent to teachers all over the country. I did long interviews with the woman who initiated this thing. They have detailed lists of every teacher in the country. In the United States, the average teacher is spending more than $500 a year of his or her own money to bring supplies into the classroom. And that has opened up the opportunity for these sponsored educational materials. It's not only ads, but also propaganda. So, for example, with the energy companies, they did elaborate curricula on environment, which say things like, incinerating is a form of recycling, global warming is a myth. The paper companies have been big. Clear cutting is sustainable forestry. Where Hauser set up a science institute for teachers to go in the summer and learn and so forth. You've had stealth. Some of this is stealth curricula where the kids, you can't tell who it's from when it's propaganda rather than ads. So you've had the State of Israel doing these, Saudi Arabia doing these. You have Mobile, which did a Mobile Oil when it was that, did a plastics curriculum that you had no way of knowing. The kids didn't know because it's a teensy little logo in the bottom of the, it was a film they did and so forth. You have junk food companies doing nutrition curricula. You have health and beauty aid companies. You have credit card companies doing financial literacy. You have automobile companies advertising. Automobile, my daughter came home with a Toyota ad for a minivan, a so-called safety brochure.
Why?
Because kids have become major influencers of parents' automotive purchases, especially in the minivan and SUV category. And so this was a minivan ad. Of course, you know I was in the school the next day, and I got a big apology. We have something called the Field Trip Factory, which, because schools no longer have money for field trips, organizes field trips. Where do they go? Toys R Us, Office Depot, honest to God, Krispy Donut Factories, pet stores. Thousands of American kids, now their field trips, no longer a museum, a zoo. It's, you don't go to the zoo anymore, you go to Petco. You get coupons so that you then ask your parents to take you back and buy you stuff. There are tons of giveaways, which are advertising cover concepts, which is book covers with ads on them. You've got Philip Morris advertising in the schools. Of course, the soda contracts, I heard on the radio yesterday something coming in from the airport, which I'm sure was coming out of this conference about the sodas. Watch out, because their strategy is to go for juice, which is virtually just as bad, or milk, which is a whole other problem, pushing milk on kids. I mean, that's a health thing. We can get into that in the workshops. Bottled water, which, of course, is so unecological and so problematic. How about water fountains? How about support to keep our infrastructure with water fountains? We've got the ShopRite Gymnasium. That's a grocery store. ShopRite Gymnasium. We have schools selling naming rights, elementary schools selling naming rights to corporations. We have contests from junk food companies. We have incentive programs to eat junk food. We also have bribing and enlisting teachers into a lot of this. Examples, a candy company, Reese's Candy, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, paid teachers in Minnesota to paint their cars with Reese's ads and park them next to the place where the kids got off, where the school bus parked and where the kids got off every morning. I kid you not. They were exposed, and they went back from that. Channel One has been implicated in bribing, giving teachers bribes if they can get their school to set up. I talked to someone from Crayola. They have the Brand Ambassadors Project, which is teachers are their brand ambassadors in the schoolroom. You have kickbacks from things like Scholastic, one of the most aggressively commercializing companies around. You sell more books, you get more stuff. McDonald's Teacher Night, where the teachers go and serve at McDonald's. What are we teaching kids? That the teachers should be, yes, pushing McDonald's. Teachers telling, what is that saying? Eat McDonald's. They also bribed the National Parent Teacher Association. When the junk food stuff started coming out, Coca-Cola gave a big fat donation to the National PTA. They got their top lobbyist on the board of the PTA. And they became yet another corporate sponsor, which if you go to the PTA website, you'll see all their corporate sponsors. Activism has pushed back. He's had to resign. There have been a lot of activist challenges. I think you'll hear about some of those in the workshops today. Many of them have been successful, but, you know, we are fighting a tsunami. Okay. Last point I want to make, how is all of this marketing affecting kids? I mentioned my survey and the findings I had on parental relationships. The purpose of this survey was to ask the question, which has really not been asked before, not just about a particular product and how its consumption affect kids. We know that tobacco ads lead to more smoking and therefore health outcomes. We know that junk food ads leads to more junk food consumption and bad outcomes on that. I wanted to ask the question, what is the impact of living in this intensely commercialized environment on kids? Is it having a more general impact than just the impacts of violent products or sexualized products or addictive products and so forth? And so I did this survey where I measured kids' media use, which is a proxy for their exposure to ads, and I developed a scale of what I call consumer involvement. How psychically and otherwise involved in consumer culture is a kid? How much do they care about being cool, watching ads, having stuff? How much do they want to be rich? How much do they feel they don't have enough? How much do they always have something they want to buy? How much do they care about designer labels and the kind of car their parents drive? And a whole range of questions. And I called that their measure of their level of involvement in consumer culture. And what I found is that the more involved a kid is in consumer culture, the more likely that child is to become depressed, the more likely that child is to have problems of self-esteem, the more likely that child is to become anxious, the more likely that child is to have frequency of headaches, stomach aches, and feeling bored. Three kind of psychosomatic, but also, you know, physiological sorts of symptoms. I used a statistical model that allows us, to the extent we can, with data at one point in time, to say what's cause and effect. Because, of course, the old canard is, it's the depressed kids who watch more TV. It's the kids who are already screwed up who get into consumer culture. And I thought that that would be true as well, that it both had an effect and was an effect. And it was really surprising to me that I found that wasn't true. All of the causal power of the model was going from consumer culture to all of these negative well-being outcomes. And they're just across the board. And there are other outcomes I could have tested, and I'm pretty sure they would have ended up pretty similar because the results were pretty strong. What I found about media was interesting. Media didn't have a direct impact on depression, anxiety, self-esteem, etc. It all worked through this consumer involvement. More media exposure leads to higher levels on that consumer involvement measure, and that in turn leads to more of these negative outcomes. This is very much in line with a growing literature in psychology on materialism and its impact on people, both for, it's been done for adolescents and for adults, but what it finds very, very strongly is that the more highly materialistic a values person's values are, the more negative outcomes in terms of more depression, more anxiety, lower life vitality, poor social connections, poor physical health. You pretty much name it. For teens, what you find is more materialism is associated with more risky behaviors, more psychological pathologies, and so on and so forth. So these findings, although the first for this age group and the first to really measure consumer involvement as opposed to just holding materialist values, are very much in line now with lots and lots of research which is pointing in this direction. And last night in the keynote, we heard about the issue of quality of life and talking about, you know, what makes a quality of life. And I guess that's the last point I want to end on, which is to reiterate that point. What these findings and more show is that quality of life is not gained by a more consumerist lifestyle. To the contrary, absolutely to the contrary, the quality of life is gained through healthy, authentic relations with families and communities, with a healthy environment, with a just democratic political system, with ethical treatment on both a local, national, and a global scale, and that those are the things which we are sacrificing in order to get more stuff, which is making our kids sick and making us sick too. Thank you.
Sociologist Juliet Shore, author of a number of books on consumer society, including Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child, and the New Consumer Culture. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Now for the second installment of our serial reading of Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. In the reading last week, Susan explained how she was motivated to become a physician in order to gain the power to alleviate suffering. As she entered the real world of medicine, she found the hospital to be like a factory where patients' feelings and doctors' compassion were irrelevant. She studied to become a psychotherapist as she noticed that the suffering she saw in her patients went beyond the body. This, too, she learned, did not get at the root of the problem. The problem was the structure of capitalist society itself, its inequality, its emptiness, the powerlessness of so many people that contributed both directly and indirectly to sickness. She began the book by writing that society is divided into two groups of people, a few who wield immense power and the rest who feel varying degrees of powerlessness. As a result, conflicts over power dominate life. Between individuals, the struggle for power kills intimacy. On a social level, competition drives down living standards. On a global scale, the battle for dominance threatens human survival. Power over others and lack of power are both corrupting. However, power, the ability to control events, can also liberate. Power is not the problem, she said. The problem is unequal access to power. Last week, she asked and answered the question of whether our unjust society persists because it reflects a brutal and uncaring human nature. No. She began to build her case that it is the powerlessness of most people in the society and their feelings of helplessness that allow the few to continue to perpetuate this unjust arrangement. She talked about the human responses to danger: fight, flight, or dissociate. Dissociation is the last defense, a psychic defense, in a situation where no physical response, flight or fight, is possible. The pain that people experience in their daily lives in a society that strips most people of their humanity, that alienates them from their labor and from the natural world and each other, often provokes dissociation. This leads to numbing that superficially resembles callousness. This week, we'll conclude part one and begin part two, where she asks and answers the question of how this state of affairs came to be. When we've read the book together many weeks from now, I'm going to interview Susan Rosenthal. I've told her, and she's very excited about the idea, that I will be soliciting questions for her from you that I will ask on your behalf. So at any point going forward, email me through the link at the website unwelcomeguests.org. Now to continue with Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. In 1916, Wilfred Trotter wrote The Instinct of the Herd in Peace and War, in which he argued that anti-war protests and workers' revolts were based on mindless herd instinct. Trotter was writing for an elite who were terrified that ordinary people might take power into their own hands. His concept of herd instinct launched the myth that people in groups behave like wild animals.